Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Maria Pappas, and today I have Josephine Taylor here with me to talk about her debut novel, Eye of a Rook. Eye of a Rook is both a historical and medical narrative exploring pain, the way it is experienced and the way it is seen or conceptualized by others. Eye of a Rook will take you as far back as the mid-1800s England and will bring you forward to contemporary Western Australia as it explores two women's experience of the same poorly understood gynecological condition, vulvodynia. Let me introduce you to Josephine. Josephine Taylor is a writer and editor who lives on Perth's coastal north. After developing chronic gynecological pain, she was forced to surrender her career as a psychotherapist. Years later, research into the condition made its way into her prize-winning PhD thesis, an investigative memoir. Josephine is an associate editor at Westerly Magazine and is an adjunct senior lecturer in writing at Edith Cowan University. Welcome, Josephine. Lovely to have you here today.
Oh, it's fantastic to be with you, Maria, and congratulations on winning the Hungerford. Lovely news.
Thank you, and congratulations you too for publishing this wonderful book. Josephine, I read Eye of a Rook over the summer, over that Christmas break, and I have to say it is such a beautifully written, intelligent and highly affecting novel, one which still stays with me today. All of the characters have remained long after I've turned that last page. Will you share a little bit about what Eye of a Rook is about?
Sure. And I'm really glad it has stayed with you because novels can come along really fast. So I'm glad the characters have stayed with you. So my novel, Eye of a Rook, follows two women who develop mystifying gynecological pain. In contemporary Perth, you have academic and writer Alice Tennant, who starts to explore the history of hysteria to make sense of her disorder. And as she does that, she draws away from her husband, Duncan. She starts to become a different kind of person. Then you also have, in Victorian London, Arthur Rochdale and his wife Emily. And Arthur is seeking help for Emily, who has also developed the same kind of disorder. He consults with the real-life surgeon Isaac Baker Brown and contemplates his radical surgery for women with hysteria. So there's a lot that connects these two women, and you would think that over 150 years, a lot would have changed in the way what is happening to them is perceived and the knowledge around it and the treatment of it. But what you find out through this narrative is actually that not a lot has changed, because the characters in both timelines encounter ignorance and dismissiveness. Their lives are altered in other ways too, because they learn about the kind of love that you need when you're suffering and also about the rich possibilities of creativity. The condition at the heart of Eye of a Rook is a condition called vulvodynia. It's a chronic pain disorder that affects the vulva, the genitals, and it affects up to or around 16% of all women at some point in their lives. So we're looking at over 2 million women. And I think that when I began to research this, what sort of really incensed me about this was that so many women were experiencing this pain, but nobody really knew anything about it. The other thing about it, I guess, too, is that the two women in Eye of a Rook have quite severe cases of vulvodynia, but vulvodynia can range in its symptoms too, through to quite sort of mild just discomfort, perhaps with pressure.
There's strong links to pain constantly throughout the novel. And what is particularly noticeable to me is the frustration and sometimes voicelessness of the person in pain. And as you were speaking, when you said 2 million women are affected, it made me think it's not just the voicelessness of the person in pain, it's the voicelessness of women in pain. And throughout the novel, you explore both the women's experience. And I noticed that for both women, the way other characters, and especially male characters, the way these characters are quick to speak for the women and quick to explain away their pain. Can you talk a little about how you did this and how important was it to you to give characters like Emily and Alice the chance to speak for themselves?
This is over years that I've been researching and working with this. So I think that I really felt that it was just critical that women were given a voice. At the same time, because I've met so many women with this condition and most of them aren't able to speak about this, in some cases it might just be that a partner knows and or a doctor might know. But I do find that whenever I present on this, people seem to be very relieved, and I get women coming up to me afterwards and saying, you know, how grateful they were, and they talk about their daughter or a colleague or whatever. So in making Alice and Emily really central, I think I wanted to explore the whole sort of befuddlement of that process of, you know, well, I've got this thing. It's completely derailing my life, but no one knows what it is. Giving voice to their sort of inarticulate helplessness. We now have a word, we have vulvodynia, but for Emily, there weren't really any words at all. And I mean, women were really silenced even more then. You know, Arthur really speaks for her. We hear Emily's voice in letters, and that was really important for me that we did hear her voice. But I was also really interested in how a man in a situation where he has some kind of power, because the men did have the power then, would deal with her pain, and whether he would empathise, whether he would speak for her. It's not only that it can be invisible, so there can be nothing there to see for a lot of women. There's also the silence around it. And I really felt strongly that I kind of wanted to break through that taboo. And the highest incident of symptom onset is between the ages of 18 to 25. So we're actually looking at quite young women at a time when they're coming into their sexuality, as Emily really is in this book. So even if women can't speak for themselves, I guess I'm hoping I can speak for them through Emily and Alice.
Yeah, Emily and Alice are not alone in this. They have partners, and Arthur is Emily's partner. And you mentioned Arthur in the 1860s. How would he respond, and would he talk for Emily, or what would he do? It turns out that he's my favourite character of the whole entire narrative. He is the classic good guy, and he's kind, he's supportive, he trusts her, he is empathic to her experience, and he treats her with such respect. And actually, he challenges my stereotype. How did you come to create Arthur?
So what happened? Well, he actually came to life really for me. I wasn't actually trying to create him. I was in a writing workshop. I was given a writing prompt, we all were. The character was meant to be looking at a painting on a wall. And so I just started writing, and spontaneously, because I had not written any fiction around this subject at all, this character, Arthur, was in a room with Isaac Baker Brown. And I was like a little gobsmacked, and he just stayed with me. I think what happened too is that I drew on my father's experiences for him. So my father also went to boarding school, and he had a trauma in his life, a loss, at the same age as Arthur, and he was told in the same way. So he experienced that loss in very much the same way. And it's something I think that's always affected the family, and certainly my dad. But what was happening is, during the time of writing, Dad was getting older, and I interviewed him substantially, and I invested Arthur with his experiences. And then Dad actually died, and the last couple of months of the writing, so I finished the final draft of the book two months after he died. So I think what happened is just my love for Dad and my boys as well, I think, my two sons. The whole thing about motherhood, to do with my relationship with my boys as well, his with his mother, it just went into that. I wanted him to be sympathetic. I felt like we really needed somebody in this book, particularly to support one of the women in a powerful kind of way.
Since some of your characters are based on real life people, so you mentioned Arthur being in a room with Isaac Brown, and since your writing is so well researched, and since you have that personal connection as well, why did you ultimately decide fiction as the way to present your research, ideas, your thoughts?
Just responding to that bit on Isaac Baker Brown, I probably first came across him in 2006, and I just spent years just intrigued by this man. And I got a copy of his book, but there was a tucked away in the front cover, there was actually a handwritten dedication from him, because it said from the author. So then I took a few years in working out who the dedication was to, and really eventually determined it was to his son, who was in New South Wales. It's a kind of tragic story. I've written a personal essay on it. But I think that he had to come into the novel, but I also didn't want him to be too central because he had such a devastating effect on so many women. My PhD thesis was great. I was learning how to write about this condition, and I couldn't have written the novel without writing that thesis first. I used that period that I did my PhD in, 2007 to 2011. I placed Alice's narrative in that time frame, and that meant that I didn't need to do more research around vulvodynia because I was kind of done by then. I finished it and I approached a couple of publishers and I wasn't getting anywhere. I tend to lose confidence really quickly, really easily. I had one publisher who said that they all read it, they all loved it. It was a small but a very good publisher, but they didn't usually publish debut memoir. And I think I just sort of ran out of puff for the moment. And then I asked Susan Medaglia, who was my mentor during the writing of the novel, to assess a personal essay. And she said, you write beautifully, et cetera. It was lovely. But she also said, you could write fiction, you know, if you wanted to. I met roadblocks that then eventually sent me in that direction. And clearly the pressure of the characters, the pressure of the material still needing to be going out into the world. I really wanted it to get out into the world. And I think that just gave the necessary sort of creative kind of push for it to happen.
Altogether, between the PhD and the novel, was it also difficult to write?
Yeah. So I actually started writing in about 2004. So we're looking at a kind of 17 years journey. And I started the PhD because I got bogged down. So then I kind of thought, well, what if I could do a PhD? The novel, I loved writing. I mean, it was hard in the way that good things can be hard, you know, that things that are pleasurable can be challenging and hard. But I loved writing it. Probably the hardest parts of the book is when Alice, where she's really at her wit's end, really at her lowest point. I found that hard to write because it took me back into that place. But at the same time, I really felt that I had to do that in order to communicate it properly. Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
I'm really interested. I have written a personal essay on this called The Lady in the Carriage. I'm really interested in trauma and the way we try to creatively resolve trauma, but I'm also really interested in the way in which trauma sort of repeats in ways which try to push us towards, I think, resolving it. So I've read and written quite a lot on this. So I was very interested in the idea of intergenerational trauma. I'm thinking about a family over a couple of centuries. I'm very interested in genetics and epigenetics, whether we're born in a particular way, whether we're fated, whether we are influenced by environment to perhaps be self-destructive or whatever. But I'm also interested in the future. So several of the family generations would be in the future, perhaps involving some kind of robotics or something like that. And I'm very interested in that kind of sense of how creativity and love, again, I think, can work through time. Backwards through time as well as forwards through time.
That sounds so fascinating, and I am going to look forward to that as much as I've enjoyed reading your current book. So we're going to finish today with a passage from Eye of a Rook.
So this is at a point where Alice is really starting to question her marriage with Duncan, and she is starting to know a little bit of what she has, and she's starting to speak her own voice, her own mind. And she's also started taking a medication for her pain, which is an old-style tricyclic antidepressant called amitriptyline, which is often used with conditions like vulvodynia. It's to do with altering pain perception. What happens with this tablet is that it knocks you out at night. So when it kicks in, you just boomf. So that's just to give you a bit of context. They watched the program together, hands intertwined. A softness admitted, a peace of sorts brokered. In the light thrown by the TV, Duncan's face was unlined, years younger than the man who had challenged her that morning. When she saw her husband like this, it was easier for Alice to believe the best of him, to think again about how her illness must affect him, this man with his sharp, directed thoughts, his ability to shape creative solutions from complex problems. But worrying about his place in this, about how he would love to be the cause of improvement or how she might soothe his hurt feelings, only made her feel guilty, reduced. And there was so little of her left, she couldn't grow smaller, could she? On the screen, Buffalo forged a river somewhere in Africa. The narrator described the action in a hushed voice. There, predators wait hungrily. Opportunistic snouts and eyes poked from the surface of the water. The young and the sick are especially vulnerable. Alice did not enjoy these nature docos as Duncan did, especially now, the battles and blood, the fight for survival. If only they could have sex, proper sex, not these fraught encounters in which more and more parts of her body felt off limits, unsafe. How could she tell him that she could hardly bear his touch? How could he believe in their love while she rejected him? How could she reassure him of her own desire when, if she moved to touch him, the rawness stabbed as if she were caught on barbed wire? Her mind, too, was unequal to the task. What she needed was an embrace without demand. This new Alice could no longer meet Duncan's demand, and she realised, with a start, with a sense of desolation, that he was powerless to help her. Duncan was absorbed. Alice refocused on the TV. Had the buffalo survived? It was raptors now. Monkeys screeched and flung themselves from tree to tree, and the two birds circled above. "They are watching and waiting," said the voiceover. Was the rift between them solely because of her illness? The new, pained Alice questioned all that had gone before, suggested there was a flaw in the foundation of their relationship, wondered if the baby she had imagined, it seemed like years ago, would have been a mistake anyway. But could she trust the thoughts and feelings of the new Alice? Was she a superior version of herself, more insightful, more mature, or a hag who no longer saw the good in her husband, who now saw the world itself through a glass, darkly? What did she make of herself, of their marriage? Obscure doubts that had hidden within the folds of her pain, only to emerge now as she tried to translate the language of her suffering. "But the raptors have a strategy," the narrator's voice again. While the monkeys, from their swaying seat in the tree canopy, watch the male disappear, his mate flies in behind, unnoticed, ready to swoop. Alice closed her eyes. From the moment of meeting, Duncan had provided an answer to her world, and she had always believed that he looked to her as some kind of compass, that life made more sense for both of them in each other's company. For what other reason had they married? She remembered their early melding and nights when he'd recounted his childhood troubles, his mother's many hospital absences as her body was remade, the loss of his father just as Ina was returned to them, fixed after a fashion. Alice had held him as he cried, felt his need for her in those boyish tears. But when she looked back through the eyes of her new self, she read a different story, a young woman in the grip of an older, seemingly smarter man, a woman who had bent herself into the form defined by his interests, his beliefs, her thoughts and hopes fenced. The compromises made to bring him pleasure, a slow whittling away at herself. Her face was wet. She blotted the tears with her sweater and opened her eyes to a burst of motion. "Look," the raptor had grasped a small monkey from the treetops. "There is no escape now." The bird flew with her prey to an outcrop of rocks, then thrust large talons into the belly. Her wings were outstretched. She raised her proud head and scanned the sky. "Isn't she beautiful?" Duncan's voice was resonant with awe. She loved that about him, his eager curiosity about the world. She loved him. What if this disorder were to disappear tomorrow? Would the crippling doubt in that love reveal itself as a chimera, an effect of pain, of despair? Surely she could, no, should, work harder to safeguard their marriage, to hold on to the remnants of what had been between them. She called back the memories, the week away last year that had shown her something different, their love and the thought of a living proof of that bond. When she recovered, they would return to that point, even plan that future. They would see the softness in each other and laugh together again. It had been good. She must remember. The raptor's cape-like wings shielded the dead monkey from the view of other predators. Mantling, the narrator pronounced. Alice could see the monkey's milky underside, the scattered splotches of brilliant red. Her skin prickled top to toe. She could feel the pecks to her belly, the tearing at her innards, glistening membranes ripping. She moved closer to Duncan and he put his arm around her. She leaned into his long body, became heavy and slack. Ah, here it came, that tiny sedating pill, that nightly bulldozer. Her eyelids dropped, glowing afterimage, the monkey's white belly and the raptor's pale eye, the round absence at its core. Then the heavy surge rolled over her body and she fell into that black hole, going, going. Alice, her shoulder gripped, shaken. Alice, come on, time for bed. She lifted her eyelids, saw a shadow hovering over her, its wings darker than the night-filled room, mantling. Was it shielding her, preparing to eat her? She couldn't move her arms or legs, couldn't fight the shadow or the heaviness. The blackness came again and carried her away.
Josephine, that was beautiful. Thank you so much, and thank you for taking the time to join us. Listeners, you can find Eye of a Rook in all good bookstores and online at fremantlepress.com.au. If you enjoyed our chat today, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Maria Pappas and I have been your host today. In 2020, I won the City of Fremantle Hungerford Award and my own novel will be out in November. Join me next time as we continue our journey into everything books.